Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. With us now, Christina Greer, Fordham University political science professor, host of the New York Politics podcast FAQ NYC, also host of the Blackest Questions podcast on the Griot, and author of the book Black Ethnics, to talk about the interview that we just heard and also some national politics like changing the presidential primary schedule. Hi, Christina. Always great to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian. Good morning.
So give me your political science professor's take on the involuntary commitment policy we've been talking about. Why this, why now, from the mayor? The deputy mayor didn't want us to look at it very much in terms of crime and public safety, but rather really helping an under-resourced population in need.
Right. I think it's probably both and. Don't forget, the mayor campaigned on crime and public safety. I mean, he's a former NYPD officer. And so I think he's always looking toward the future. And he knows that re-election is just around the corner. And if New Yorkers still feel, and don't forget, there's perception and reality, but if New Yorkers still feel that the subway is a little bit dangerous or the city feels a little bit dangerous, and that does not bode well for the mayor. And so I think he's trying to come up with various solutions to assuage some of those fears. But I think the rubber hits the road. I thought your question about who makes the decision to take people into the hospital is one that is really important. How do New Yorkers decide? You know, so many New Yorkers see people in distress and they are concerned. I mean, I think this is one of the most caring cities I've ever lived in. But there are a lot of New Yorkers who don't want to call the NYPD because they know it could escalate into a situation where there could be some really grave or dire results. But then other folks recognize that, you know, there possibly aren't enough licensed professionals to come and de-escalate a situation. So I think the mayor needs to articulate the minutiae and the details of this policy a lot more to make a lot of New Yorkers feel better about this program. Because let's be clear, there are a lot of New Yorkers who honestly want something like this. They want people to be taken care of in some capacity, but it does possibly open up a door for a slippery slope for people to be committed against their will or without a real evaluative process that is clear to New Yorkers.
Yeah, the one possibly clarifying thing that she said, if I heard her correctly, is that it's not the police or the mental health professionals on the scene, if they're called to the scene, who make the decision to involuntarily commit someone as an inpatient. All they can decide to do is take someone to the hospital at the moment, and then it's the staff at the hospital who decides on actual involuntary commitment. Is that a meaningful distinction that maybe the public has misunderstood so far?
Yes, but no. I mean, but here's the thing, Brian. So I fully understood the analysis of it is someone at a hospital who makes that evaluative call. That makes sense. And I think a lot of New Yorkers fully understand that. But we're talking about the several steps before someone gets to the hospital. So when we see someone in distress, whether it's on the street or on a subway platform, what are the steps that then take us to the hospital? So is someone going to call the NYPD? Does someone who is a licensed professional magically appear? Is this a 311 conversation? Is there a new number that we now memorize as New Yorkers to call in case we see someone in distress? So I think that's the piece. No one's saying that, you know, cops are going to evaluate, you know, an individual on the platform right then and there. We understand that happens at a hospital, but how do we get that person in need to a hospital? Is that someone where you call the police? And we all know, I think a lot of New Yorkers, especially New Yorkers of color, are really reticent to call the NYPD for anything because we've seen things take such a drastic turn and very quickly at that.
And listeners, we can take a few more of your reactions to the mayor's new policy. We took many phone calls last week, as many of you know, but do you think it's going to work in the interest of those who he aims to help? Will it also reduce random violence or anything you heard from the deputy mayor in that interview that you want to react to? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We'll get to the national politics and the change in the primary schedule later with Christina Greer, political science professor at Fordham. We'll stay on this for a few more minutes, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. The deputy mayor also said she can't project a number of people who'll be involuntarily committed or how much of a reduction in random violence by people with severe mental illness the city would likely see next year. But she indicated that the number of people actually involuntarily committed under this program would be small. I wonder if you heard that and if you think that we're imagining some kind of big sweep that isn't exactly what they're planning.
Yeah, I highly doubt that, you know, or maybe I'm being slightly naive or just hopeful on a Monday morning, but I don't see it turning into, you know, massive sweeps of people just being, you know, taken to hospitals and committed against their will or evaluated against their will. I do think that the mayor is trying to figure out some creative solutions or things that possibly haven't been done in the past to try and get people assistance. But I think this goes back to your initial question, Brian, where it is a combination of making sure we get New Yorkers the help they need, but also making sure New Yorkers feel safe, because that actually is the unit of measure that Mayor Adams is very clear that he'll be assessed on, not just as his 1 year anniversary comes around the corner, but obviously as we start talking about a primary season for the mayor's race, which I know it sounds insane, but is going to be a upon us before we know it.
Julie in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Julie.
Hi. My gosh, I have so many comments to make, but I'll try to not be so emotional. I have a family member, a brother, who is definitely in need of psychiatric care. He is institutionalized against his will currently. And for us and our family, it's been absolutely horrible. The social isolation from his family has increased since they've institutionalized him. It's almost prison-like conditions. Every time we make an appointment to see him, it's invariably canceled because of COVID. When we do see him, we are escorted into a bare room with two chairs, no access to the doctors, the nurses, the social staff. There's an aide who sits and waits for us to have our half-hour interview or conversation with my brother. In other institutions, we have had free access during visiting hours. We didn't have to make an appointment. We would just go. We saw my brother a lot more often. It's just he's deteriorating in his physical work capacity because there's no exercise. He doesn't get enough exercise. I used to walk 2 miles with him every, you know, a couple of times a week. So, you know, he had his own home. He managed his own affairs. But, yes, he does need psychiatric care. This has just been awful. He has also, in the last 2 years, had lice 3 times, had to have his head completely shaved because of the conditions in the hospital. He had never had lice in his life before he entered this institution.
This all sounds so horrible. Julie, let me jump in and ask you kind of big picture. What I think I hear you saying is, we need to not only be talking about under what conditions is it right to take someone to the hospital, to involuntarily commit them in the hospital, but we also need to be looking at the treatment of the patients who are involuntarily committed, and that's not enough part of the conversation yet, yes?
Absolutely. The need by the staffing at this institution, obviously everyone is working very hard and has their professional and their personal hearts in this matter, but they need so much more. The staffing is understaffed. We can't even get a phone call into him. A call is picked up by another patient as opposed to a staff member, and we get 10 minutes on the phone, which gets cut off, which, by the way, is less time allowed than Rikers Island prisoners get on a phone. It's really, it's not good.
What do you think the alternative was in the case of your family member?
Well, they keep asking us, can anybody take care of him? We are all, my family is an aging family. We're all over 60, and my brother is in his 70s. They're looking for someone else to take him home and take care of him. But he does need psychiatric care. I mean, this is, I'm not saying he shouldn't be
right
there.
Yeah.
The conditions are so awful.
Right. I understand you're not even saying that he shouldn't be there, but the conditions are so awful. Julie, thank you very much. This does need to be part of the conversation, obviously. Here is James, who says he's an emergency physician in Wayne. James, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call. Listen, I deeply appreciate the mayor's efforts to address a problem, but as an emergency physician, I find it incredibly problematic to deal with psychiatric patients because they come in by the police or social worker or somebody, and then finally when you get to them, they're reticent to give you information, and you don't even have the history of what brought them in the first place. And you have a very strict criteria. Are they a clear and present danger to themselves or others? Not are they acting crazy? Not are they doing things that other people would find erratic? But are they a clear and present danger? So they come in, no history, no information available about the circumstances that brought them in. They're not giving you information, and you don't know enough information to say we're going to hold this person against their will. And the fact that they've had repeated visits. We have drug users that come in with overdoses all the time. The repetition right. of that behavior is not enough to keep them against their will.
But if you're an emergency room physician, maybe you can give us a sense from behind the scenes of what are considered sufficient criteria to involuntarily commit somebody. Because I think if you heard the interview with the deputy mayor, she was saying that. The goal here is, first of all, that's only done in the hospital. It's not done on the street by police or mental health professionals there. And it's done in the hospital based on what they hope will be a holistic evaluation, not just if they're kind of out of control at the moment or out of it at the moment, but whether they can meet their basic needs in a more ongoing way. So what's a best practice from inside the emergency room, given your experience?
Well, I'll just start from ahead of the emergency room. If the deputy mayor spoke of an accumulation of information, and if there's an accumulation of information on an individual, then whomever is accumulating that information needs to channel it to a source that addresses mental health needs. The best practice in the emergency room, if somebody comes in with evidence by an observer that they are a clear and present danger to themselves, that observation has to be categorized, collected, and detailed. And then you need to know what's the phone number of the person that observed that erratic and inappropriate behavior. Do we have family phone numbers? Frequently the people that are homeless and are in the circumstances like that have no social network to contact to ascertain how long this has been going on, what other acts that might be considered dangerous are going on. So just being out in the cold is not enough. Did they push somebody? Did they use a weapon? Did they do something to themselves, like walking in the street in front of traffic? You know, clear information with regard to what the dangerous behavior was that makes them unable negotiate the world on their own has to come in.
So on a scale from there are too many people on the street who are unable to meet their basic needs, and so it's compassionate to take them in on this basis more, to there are too many people already involuntarily committed and we should be letting more of them go, where would you fall?
I think there are a large number of people on the street that need access to care, and I would fall more on the side of addressing those needs. But to pretend that the emergency department, which is trying to deal with the trauma patient, the HIV patient, is this COVID? Is this a heart attack? Is this a stroke? Mm-hmm. You know, that is not the place where these needs to be addressed. These needs should be addressed.
James, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Jessica in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jessica.
Oh, hi. I'm just listening to the emergency room doctor, and I think he brought up a lot of good points, and that's as far as resources and overburdening the emergency rooms. I think one of the overlooked things that we don't discuss enough is not what should be done or how it should be done, but where are the resources to actually get it done? And mm-hmm. and for me, as somebody who was attacked, I feel like these are very important concerns.
When you say someone like you who was attacked, do you want to go into that at all? Obviously, it's up to you, and how it relates to this policy.
I was attacked by an unwell man in Prospect Park over the summer that resulted in my dog dying. And, you know,
oh my God,
besides,
that's you. I've read so much about your case. Yes.
And I, you know, I also do question, you know, a valid concern from the police on many different angles, but not only will they react, but do they have the actual resources to know how to react in situations?
So do you think it would have, that if this policy was in effect a year ago, that your incident would never happened and have happened and your dog would be alive today?
I can't, that's a difficult question to answer. I think that there is a very strong lack of resources that are being dedicated to actually solving the problem, and this is really just for optics.
Jessica, thank you for your call. I appreciate you having the courage to call in when you've been in the limelight and criticized yourself over what happened to you.
Thank you for that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, Christina Greer, that was a very interesting set of callers that we took there, and that was a surprise to me, the woman, and I'm not going to go into all the background for the listeners because it would take too long, but the woman at the center of that Prospect Park case where her dog was killed, and there's, you know, different opinions on whether the person who allegedly did it has been sufficiently identified and should have been taken in some way.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I'll start with Julie, the first caller, which, you know, I think Julie made a really interesting point in the sense that she represents, I mean, thousands upon thousands of families in New York, Brian, that are really struggling with how to get the best care for their loved ones while also working within a system that clearly needs an overhaul, which I think leads into the next caller, who's the ER doctor, where I think the larger question, I think some of the frustration people have with the mayor and his team seems to be the either the articulation of coordination efforts or the fact that maybe the coordination efforts aren't in place. You know, there were stories about sort of NYPD officers not fully knowing that this was even going to be a policy or a plan that even was an option. And so the articulation of what is happening and who all will be involved, I think is really important to let New Yorkers know. So we also know how to act and what our next steps are. And as for the last call, I mean, I think that story is really a difficult one because it has to do a lot with race and class and gentrification and resources. I mean, we always have to remember the city and this country, we have an abundance of resources. It's just how those resources are allocated and who gets them and who doesn't. And so I think when we talk about resources, we want to be a little more specific about, you know, this is one of the richest cities and countries in the world. So we have it. It's just who gets it and who decides who gets it and when.
Yeah. So let me make this the last question on this topic before we turn the page and talk about the new presidential primary schedule as proposed and some other things. The question I was asking the deputy mayor about the systemic roots of the number of visibly mentally ill people on the streets of the city, disproportionately black and brown, and the fact that the focus right now appears to be on treating the individual, less dramatically on treating the systemic roots. She took issue with that and said maybe there just isn't enough media coverage of how Mayor Adams is committed to what she called and what he has called the upstream roots of violence as well as mental illness. So I'm curious your take on that and what they could be doing policy-wise that maybe you think they aren't in that respect, or is it an unfair knock by critics when, you know, so much of the city and state budget do go to education and healthcare and jobs programs like the deputy mayor was referencing. What do you think about all of that?
Yeah, Brian, I mean, there are a few things going on. I mean, we also have to recognize that so much of the mayor's budget is already spoken for before he even, you know, took office. But if we remember his campaign, he talked a lot about, Bishop Tutu's famous quote, you know, we keep seeing people drowning in the river, so we have to go upstream and figure out why it is that they're all falling in the river. And that really resonated with a lot of folks. But I do think that, you know, it reminds me of sort of when you write a book and everyone's like, yay, I'm done. It's like, no, writing the book is only 50%. You know, letting people know that you wrote the book, letting people know what's in the book is the other 50%. And I think with this particular mayor and his administration, they're essentially saying, well, we're doing the work. You know, why don't you all look? Here are all the ways that we're working with, you know, various deputies and different community groups and neighborhoods, and we're trying innovative things. Well, it's like, it doesn't matter if the average New Yorker doesn't know that these things are happening, or they don't feel as though these things are happening. So there has to be some sort of, you know, campaign to let us know where we are, what you're doing, and how we fit into the narrative of what you're doing. It's, you know, I think Obama struggled with this quite a bit with his America Rediscovery Back to Work Act. It's like, you're too busy working on trying to solve the problem, but if you don't let the voters know what you're doing while you're doing it, and why you're doing it on their behalf, then folks don't feel as though you're really working on their behalf. And this particular issue is sticky, because I think that there are a lot of folks who believe one thing, but, you know, in practice, it gets a little murky. I think there are a lot of folks who genuinely don't trust the mayor because he does have an NYPD background, and they feel as though that no matter what policy he chooses, what policy path he chooses, is going to be a more draconian NYPD-based policy. Mm-hmm. And so it's really incumbent upon him and his team and his staff, of which he's hired very qualified people, by the by, to make sure that New Yorkers understand what they're doing, why they're doing it, and where New Yorkers fit in those solutions.
You know, let me extend this by one phone call, because I think Christine in Carroll Gardens has what looks like a very interesting and relevant story. Christine, thank you for calling in. You're on WNYC.
Hi, thank you. First off, my heart goes out to the woman who lost her dog, and I come from a family with medical people, so I understand what the emergency room doctor is saying as well. But I was on the F train, waiting for the F train. It was right before the pandemic hit, maybe a year before the pandemic. And there was a woman sitting on the seats. And it was in the morning. It was like 8:30, going into work. And I look young, but I actually have a cane to walk with. So I had to sit. So I was sitting on the far seat. So we both had the end seat. And she was mumbling to herself, but, you know, just kind of, you know, as New Yorkers do, we just kind of like go and do our own thing. And I turned to look to see when the train was coming, and she caught my eye. And at that point, she, for some reason, thought that I was having relations with her son, we'll put it like that. And she came up to me, and she punched me in the face. There was a whole bunch of people standing there. People just watched. And I was shocked the first time, and then she hit me again. And I only weigh 100 pounds. I'm 5'8", so I'm kind of slight. So I stood up at this point and had my cane, and I was like, get back from me, and, you know, was yelling. In the meantime, people were just standing there. So I called 911 from the train station. I did, as I was fending off this woman. Mm-hmm. The train had pulled into the station, so the train had stopped. People were standing there. At one point, a man came over to me, and he's like, here, let's get away from her. The police showed up. They took her, and they were going to arrest her. And I said, please do not arrest this woman. She's clearly not well. So it took about 20 minutes. There was a lot of cops down there. Every time I caught her eye, she just was angry. Like, I don't know why it was me. But they eventually, there was a woman police officer with me, and there was an ambulance outside. So they checked me out. I was fine. And then I said, you know, I want her admitted somewhere. And she said, well, we'll see what we can do. I said, I don't want her arrested. I'm just going to say that flat out. She doesn't need to be arrested. She needs help. So 20 minutes, half hour went by, and they did get a place for her. And according to the police, I believe them, they said that she was not getting arrested, that she was going in to seek medical attention, like mental health.
Yeah. And do you think it took your intervention as the victim saying, yeah, I don't want her arrested, I want her to get help, that made that difference as to how she was treated? Do you think it was?
Absolutely, 100%. Absolutely. I must have said that 5, 6, 7 times. I just emphasized it so much because she didn't need to be in a cell. Like, she would be fighting with somebody else there, and then somebody would really get injured.
And so, considering what you've been through, when you hear this policy articulated by the mayor, does it make you think, oh, good, more people like my attacker are going to get help, hopefully proactively before it comes to something like that? Or do you think, uh-oh, more police, more danger for everybody?
I really wish we would not put police on the street and we would have mental health advocates like they do in San Francisco and other cities, where you can walk around and see people with a backpack on talking to the homeless people. And you know they're there to ask them if they need anything. I've seen it in Ireland. I've seen it, you know, in San Francisco. I should say I've seen it in Dublin, where they go to the young people and they make sure that they have a place to stay because they might be from an abused home or whatever the situation. I've physically seen it happening. So I also come from, I lived in Pittsburgh for 10 years where they had beat cops, and that was in the 90s. And I knew my cops. I knew who they were. They knew the neighborhood. They knew the people in the neighborhood. So I kind of advocate for beat cops again. Mm-hmm. I don't think that'll ever happen. And I really would like to see more mental health advocates. Oh, I think beat cops would be great because they know the neighborhood.
Thank
they
you
know
for
the kids who are there.
Christina, I have to go, but thank you for sharing your story and thinking about this as you have. Thank you very, very much. And Christina, one last thought before we really turn the page. That was quite an interesting story. And some listeners may hear San Francisco used as a model and think, wait, everything I hear about San Francisco is that it's even worse than New York in terms of unhoused people living on the street.
Yeah, I mean, San Francisco, I've spent some time there, and it definitely feels a lot worse than New York in a lot of ways. I think this last caller, though, is so indicative of so many New Yorkers, Brian, in that even when something happens to them personally, they're still, certain New Yorkers, not all, they're still reticent to get the police involved because they understand the person who may have attacked them, if it's not life-threatening, clearly needs more than a jail cell. And they recognize that being in a jail cell will probably exacerbate the issue in a host of ways. And so trying to figure out what is that transitional step, and I think that's what you were trying to get at with the deputy mayor, what's that transitional step before they possibly make it to the hospital? Because even an interaction with an armed police officer can obviously escalate someone's not just blood pressure, but their behavior, whether they are mentally challenged or not.
Listeners, thank you for all your thoughtful calls. We'll take a break, then turn to President Biden's proposal to overhaul the presidential primary calendar for 2024. Goodbye, Iowa and New Hampshire. Hello, South Carolina and Michigan as the first states to go. Christina Greer will stay with us for that. We hope you do, too. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Fordham University political science professor Christina Greer is our guest. Listeners, have you heard yet about President Biden's proposal to overhaul the presidential primary calendar for 2024? Goodbye, Iowa and New Hampshire as the first states to go. Hello, South Carolina and Michigan. We can take some of your reactions, 212-433-WNYC, or questions, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Christina, why were Iowa and New Hampshire first in the first place? What's the history there?
Oh, I can't really remember the exact history of why those two were chosen. I should know this, Brian, but it's somewhere deep in the crates of my brain. But, you know, don't forget, Iowa's a caucus and New Hampshire's a primary. Those are two very different things. And so a caucus is, you know, people don't sort of cast a ballot. It's more of persuasion. It's an older tactic. It's been great to elevate people like, you know, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, Barack Obama, Jimmy Carter, you know, folks who weren't necessarily considered, you know, contenders, and then they, you know, go to Iowa, and if you have a great ground game and a solid team, they can kind of catapult you into the conversation when it comes to New Hampshire, where it's the very first primary. Some of the critiques, obviously, Brian, have been those two states aren't really reflective of the great diversity that we have in this nation. And so why is it that those two states really get to sort of set the pace as to who's in the real conversation to become a presidential contender?
So South Carolina is not a swing state, but it is a majority Black Democratic primary electorate state. Here is South Carolina Congressman Jim Clyburn on All Things Considered yesterday. Remember, his endorsement of Biden in 2020 in that primary did so much to help Biden win that primary and propel him to the nominations. So here's Jim Clyburn on reasons why he argues South Carolina is representative of America.
If the PD of our area is agriculture, you go to the Piedmont area, is manufacturing. You go to the Midlands, is the educational institutions, the Low Country, tourism. And then you look at what we like to call the defense industry. It is what this country is all about.
Congressman Jim Clyburn on All Things Considered yesterday. So, Christina, I guess his argument is really there are so many different kinds of people in so many different kinds of jobs and living situations and geographical contexts in South Carolina that if you can win there, it's a good bellwether for who would be electable in the general. I'm curious if you have an opinion about whether that's true.
I mean, obviously, you know, Jim Clyburn is a great advocate for his state. So, yes, he would say that. I think we're just being a little more, you know, let's put our cards on the table. African-Americans are disproportionately Democratic. And, you know, this is a state with a very significant African-American population. So if you are a Democrat, one would think that you would want to do well or need to do well in South Carolina, possibly as a bellwether to how you will do with African-Americans across the state. Don't forget, Bernie Sanders couldn't trouble himself to go down to South Carolina to meet with James Clyburn and go to his famous fish fry, where all candidates, you know, go and shake hands with all the different types of electeds in the state of South Carolina, Democratic electeds. And so Joe Biden understood that. He understood also the power of the African-American vote in the primary. And so we see that South Carolina obviously delivered very large for Joe Biden. I wrote a piece in the Washington Post at the beginning of the year, Brian, making the argument why I thought Georgia actually should be the first primary state, just because it is trending towards purple. And so instead of it, you know, it looks more like a swing state, and it has a diverse, not just African-American population, but it has a growing Latino and also Asian-American population. It has a growing immigrant population. It has mixed class. It is definitely a southern state, but I thought that it was a little more indicative of certain ways that Democrats could sort of see how they look across the country.
Yeah, and since you're watching Georgia, I'll ask you a Walker Warnock question or two before we run out of time. But I think maybe the part of this story that's getting lost in, you know, the short headline version coverage is that it's not just about South Carolina going first. It's that they would front load other states that are swing states also near the top of the primary calendar, and particularly Georgia and Nevada and Michigan. And so I guess my question for you as a political scientist is, does it matter who wins the earliest states? That seems to be the goal here, or maybe you need to help us clarify the goal. That seems to be the goal, to make sure that the candidates who are the Democratic nominees who get the biggest head start in the primaries and therefore are the likeliest to be the nominee have tested themselves in the places where the general election is going to be decided.
Right. I think, Brian, you know, I've been tussling with this question for quite some time because I do think that front loading more swing states like Michigan and Georgia, Nevada and Arizona, especially with their growing Latino populations, and we know Latino voters are sort of flirting with the Republican Party at greater rates, much greater rates than African Americans have. I do think, though, that it's worth entertaining, largely because the homogeneity of Iowa and New Hampshire are so glaring. And we also know primary voters are a different type of voter. So they're not the general election voters. But I do think that that information for the Democratic Party would be a little more substantive than the information that a state like Iowa or New Hampshire gives the party when it comes to choosing a potential nominee.
And you mentioned Iowa giving a shot to people like Jimmy Carter and Barack Obama to establish themselves in the public eye. But we've also seen so many examples, including in 2020, where the winner of Iowa and New Hampshire, and in 2020, Biden placed fourth and fifth in those two. And Bernie Sanders was in the lead when they went to state number three, South Carolina, where it doesn't wind up that way, that the Iowa-New Hampshire winners go on to be the nominee.
That's right. And I think also, you know, because in some ways, Iowa feels like a straw poll, depending on, you know, a candidate every now and again. But, you know, I also think that Iowa, because it's a caucus and the way that we measure success is not traditional. I think that that can sort of, especially with the last sort of two cycles, I believe it was, you know, a lot of folks felt like, well, the counting is off, you know, so the democratic process feels weakened because there's less faith in how we actually assessed these results from Iowa. And so the kind of the idea of a caucus writ large makes some people feel unsettled and not really clear as to whether or not they can trust the results.
This is WNYC, FM, HD, and AM New York, WNJT, FM, 88.1 Trenton, WNJP, 88.5 Sussex, WNJY, 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO, 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio and live streaming at WNYC.org at exactly 11 o'clock as we continue for a few more minutes with Fordham political science professor Christina Greer on this presidential primary calendar reboot that the Democrats, but apparently not the Republicans, are proposing for themselves, and a couple of other national politics things to come. And James in Wilton, Connecticut, you're on WNYC. Hi, James.
Hi, Brian. How are you doing?
Good.
So I'm a voter in Connecticut, or now I'm actually in Massachusetts. I'm from Connecticut. I'm in Connecticut right now. Connecticut is like, I don't know, way down on the list of the order that states vote in. It's probably, I think they vote in June. And so what I was frustrated about was, like, by the time it gets to Connecticut, like, the presidential primary's kind of already decided. Like, yeah, we can vote, but, like, it's, you know, people drop out by then. There's the Super Tuesday, which is in March. What I never understood is, why can't we all just vote on the same day? Like, every state. Just, there's, like, a primary day, say, March 15th. I don't know, whenever. And everyone just votes on the same day. It just feels like that would be, like, way more fair. I just, it's, like, so frustrating. Yeah. I don't know when Massachusetts votes. I haven't registered yet. I just moved there. But, like, I don't know. It's, every year it's very frustrating. Like, I wanted someone, the last presidential, like, race, I think I wanted Elizabeth Warren, and she dropped out on Super Tuesday. It's like, well, where's my voice in this? Like, by the time...
Yeah,
like
no, said, that's a really interesting June, question. Another alternative model. Why not? Have you given this some thought, Christina, as a political scientist? Why not have one massive national primary day and everybody in all the states will get equal weight?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic question. I mean, I think these are all old vestiges of, you know, negotiations when we sort of really grapple with, you know, federalism, anti-federalism. But I definitely hear the last caller, I mean, in the sense that, you know, we can look at probably the rates of participation from some of these latter states, and they don't have the same selection that earlier states have. They don't actually have the same motivation either. I mean, this is also, you know, why don't we have Election Day as a holiday? I mean, there's so many ways that we make it hard for our constituencies to actually participate equally in our democratic process, small d democratic process. It's very frustrating for some, especially for me as an educator who's trying to get young people involved in politics in every single aspect, not just running for not running for office, but, you know, participating in various ways. If someone is from Connecticut and they would say, well, why do I even need to participate? Because my candidate's not even in the race. And, you know, by then, you know, the candidate is oftentimes pretty much chosen, you know, unless we're thinking about 2008 with Obama and Clinton. But I think, Brian, you know, the overhaul of our electoral system is obviously a conversation that needs to be had. We have to also recognize, though, that the deep incumbency advantage on both sides of the aisle is so entrenched in our democratic process that there's not an incentive for a lot of elected officials to want to change a lot of our systems. They know who votes for them. They know who turns out in a primary. They know who their base is. And that's what helps them get reelected every 2 or 4 years. So there really isn't a strong incentive. This goes for Republicans and Democrats to actually change the system. If it benefits them, why would you want to open it up to, say, young voters or new voters? Because you don't know who those people are, and they may not be voters for you. And so I think that's the dark underbelly of our democratic process that I really struggle with as a political scientist.
Kira in Brooklyn, originally from New Hampshire. You're on WNYC. Hi, Kira.
Hi. Yeah, so I am originally from New Hampshire and grew up with the whole, you know, first in the nation kind of rah-rah sort of stuff. I think this is a great idea. New Hampshire is a small state. It is pretty homogenous still. I think it's time to change the guard.
Have you been speaking to people from back home? Because I understand they're ready to go to political war over this.
Yeah, I have not. And mostly it's because I don't think I want to make enemies where I'm from. But I think it's time for New Hampshire to realize that there are other things at stake than just being the first. I know it's tradition, but there are things that are changing that have been changing in the nation. And I think that New Hampshire needs to recognize that it's time to let go.
Kira, thank you very much. Let's go on to one or two other things. Christina, an explosion of early voting in Georgia. It's being described by some media as an explosion of early voting ahead of tomorrow's actual election day in that Warnock versus Walker Senate race. Georgia being the state that people boycotted not that long ago for having supposedly restrictive new voting laws. How do you see the numbers?
I'm excited that so many Georgians care about who their next senator will be. I'm definitely frustrated that Senator Warnock has to actually compete against someone who's so wholly not qualified in Herschel Walker. I think it says a lot about who Republicans think African-Americans are, but also how they view the Senate to even choose him as a possible candidate to represent the state of Georgia. I'm hoping that so many Georgians recognize that even though Democrats have a slim margin, they still need to show up and make sure that Senator Warnock goes back to Washington, D.C. after this election, just to make sure we can somewhat neutralize the mansions and the cinemas of the party and actually get something done, no matter how slim or difficult it may be in these next 2 years. I know it'll be very difficult, obviously, with the House being Republican and Republican members of the House already saying that, you know, legislation is not on their docket. Hunter Biden's laptop is their main priority and impeachment of the president is their main priority. I really do think that Georgia is crucial. Yeah. And I think we should be inspired by the number of people who are actually lining up to hopefully return Senator Warnock to the Senate.
Well, I want to ask you what you think about the way that these early voting demographics are being reported, because it kind of makes it less like a secret ballot that we find out who everybody was who voted demographically and how they voted only at the end of the process. Because what I'm seeing in news reports is they're saying how many early votes have come in and from what geographic areas. I've seen the stat, 1 million people age 55 and over had voted as of the other day. I saw the stat, 200,000 more women than men, which, you know, given the usual gender gap, gives you an indication probably of who's leading. And then it becomes more of a rolling contest than an entirely secret balloting process until it's over. I'm thinking of it like a football or a soccer game. You get to halftime and the coach has to assess if you're winning or losing, which you can kind of tell by these demographics, I think, and try to adjust with a last minute strategy. You know, I'm imagining some kind of new negative smear that might even be a lie that the public doesn't even have time to vet and digest. But that's just the worst case scenario. Maybe this is a good thing. What do you think about all this information being revealed as they go along?
Yeah, you know, Brian, I've been sitting with this one and I haven't come to a conclusion just yet about this kind of real-time information. Because don't forget, you know, the gender gap does and does not exist in the sense that African-American women are so disproportionately Democratic. It makes it seem as though there's a gender gap. But actually, white women are Republicans, especially in the state of Georgia. And so it depends on which district we're talking about where we have this overabundance of women voting, because white women in Georgia voted for the Republican candidate in greater percentages than they did for the Democratic candidate.
Although I think white women voted for Trump nationally in 2016, but voted for Biden nationally in 2020. Or maybe that was just white college-educated women.
Just the college-educated women.
College-educated. But something had switched that didn't switch for the men in the same category.
Right. White men are calcified as Republicans, in the same way Black women are by and large calcified as Democrats. I think, you know, this real-time information, though, Brian, can do one of two things. It could motivate people to say, okay, great, my candidate is winning, so let me go and be a part of it. It could, in some ways, suppress it, in the sense that if you get this real-time data and tomorrow you've got childcare or parent care, or, you know, you've got to work, or there's traffic, or there's, God forbid, rain, you could say, well, my candidate's already up, you know, depending on, you know, if this data is correct. So, like, I'm sure my vote isn't going to really count, so I can kind of, you know, stay home. So part of me can get frustrated a little bit with real-time data because it can sway people's behavior on actual election day. What you said about negative ads, Brian, is so astute. I talk to my students about it all the time. You know, everyone says they hate negative ads, but we use negative ads. Why? Because they work. And especially negative ads that come out on a day, say like today, where it would be too late for someone to respond to said negative ad. And the brilliance of negative ads is they always have an element of truth. Oftentimes negative ads aren't just pure whoppers, they have a slight element of truth to them. So you have to sort of dissect what is being interpreted or interpolated in said ad. So hopefully the Walker campaign isn't that organized or coordinated. We shall see. To go against Senator Warnock, I can't state enough just how frustrated I am that Senator Warnock has to even deal with this type of candidate. But I do think that real-time data has a lot of pros and cons. And I think that we'll probably be studying this race for the next few years to see not just the use of ads, the use of race and gender in a Southern state, but also how we have used this data to either increase turnout or suppress turnout.
Speaking of organized disinformation campaigns, last question. Have you been grappling personally with whether to get off Twitter? We've seen the numbers of a million or millions of people leaving the platform because of Elon Musk and what he's doing. On the other hand, I don't know if you heard Kai Wright's show last night, Notes from America, but he had a great long conversation with a Black journalist, actually two Black journalists, who have decided for the moment they're staying on Twitter because there's more opportunity to create community, more opportunity to be heard by powers that be, then there is a downside for them, at least at the moment, in abandoning the site because of its problems, its racism, its disinformation. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm no fan of Elon Musk. I've been very clear about that. But I, you know, I, maybe I'll just be the person rearranging the deck chairs as the Titanic sinks, but I don't plan on leaving. I've definitely found a political community on Twitter. I've definitely found a lot of political friendships, personal friendships. I'm a birder, so my birding community is partially on Twitter. I'm not really on any other social media platform. Every now and again, I'm on Instagram, but that's basically just birds and cats. So this is my political outlet, and I've met some really wonderful, intellectually brilliant people through this site. It definitely feels as though, you know, there are a lot of folks who have left, but I don't plan on leaving. I think, you know, I'll probably log on one day and it'll just say, you know, that 404 error, and we'll realize that it's come to a close. I also haven't signed up for any new sites just yet. I need to do a little more research as to the difference between like Mastodon and Post and all these other sites. I lean towards not liking to be on social media. You know, I know boredom and, yeah, you know, my editors like me to be on social media. So yeah, people actually know what I'm writing and what I'm doing. But because Black women specifically are disproportionately targeted on social media, it has also been a very difficult place to be. Every now and again, I use my block button and my mute button liberally and expeditiously, I should say.
Well, maybe in 6 months, we'll see if there's a birding Mastodon community to rival the birding Twitter community. If you can't have a birding community on a site called Twitter, where can you have one?
Where can you have it?
But we leave it there with Fordham University political science professor Christina Greer. She also hosts the podcast FAQ NYC, which is a New York City politics podcast. And wait, I have the other one here, the one from the Griot. Is it called The Blackest Questions?
That's right. It's Game Show. where I have people on and I ask some questions about Black history, because Black history is American history.
Game show host, political podcaster, political science professor, birder, Christina Greer. Thank you so much, as always.
Thanks so much, Brian. Happy Monday.